Seattle Supersonics win their first ever NBA championship.
We were the best. We were champions. We were family.
There's a lot of wonderful memories, and people still remember it.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm Kevin Pelton, and in this two-part podcast, we're going to look back on the Seattle Supersonics team that won the franchise's only NBA championship 4 decades ago. In today's part one, Lenny Wilkins builds the core of a championship team and guides the Sonics to an unprecedented in-season turnaround from one of the league's worst records to the NBA Finals the same year. Our story starts in May 1977. After Bill Russell resigned as coach following a 40-42 season out of the playoffs, the Sonics replace him with assistant coach Bob Hopkins. At the same time, they also bring back a familiar face as director of player personnel, Wilkins, a player coach for the team before being traded to Cleveland in 1972. Here's how Wilkins remembers it.
And they used to have a couple of big charity events, and at one of them that I was at, the owner of the Sonics.
That's Sam Shulman, the team's principal owner from its founding in 1967 all the way through 1983.
Was following me around all night long, trying to talk me into coming back to working for the Sonics. I was a little upset with them because, I had been a player coach for them and helped turn the team around and so forth. And then when they changed general managers, they wanted me to play or coach, not do both. And so I said, well, I would play because I felt that I could play for another year or two. But they didn't. They wound up trading me to Cleveland. So I was a little, at first I wouldn't go to Cleveland. A lot of the fans protested here. Then we came back to play, and they had signs all up over the Coliseum, saying this is Lenny's country. And I couldn't believe it, but they rooted for the Cavaliers the whole game, and we beat them. That was the first time the Cavaliers beat them. So that night at the dinner when the owner was kept talking to me, because by now I had retired and I was I had worked for CBS. And so I decided that I would because I thought that we had great fans here. I had made my home here and I knew the players on the team. And I thought I could really make a difference for them. So I finally agreed that I would come back into the front office. And when I got into, as soon as I came into the front office, they had a couple of possible deals to make. And one of them was they were going to trade Fred Brown to the Lakers for a kid named Tatum. And I blocked the deal and I said, no. Fred is worth more than that, and we're not going to do it. So I stopped it. And the owner, because he wanted me, he said, whatever you want is fine. So I blocked that deal. And then I made a couple of other deals. I traded for Gus Williams because he was having contract problems with the Warriors. And he they wouldn't sign him. So I said, I'd take him, and so I wanted to see what they wanted for him. And at that time, what they wanted was to see if we would pay his deferred income he had coming. And when I found out how much it was, I made the deal, and then I told the owner. But he said, you think it's worth it? And I said, yes, I do. And so we traded for him. And then I traded a second-round pick for John Johnson because I had played with him, in Cleveland. Yeah, and I knew what he could do for us and how he could help us. I mean, I had envisioned all this, how he could fit in. So we did that, and then also we traded for Marvin Webster and Paul Silas.
Before all this was the NBA draft, where Wilkins had targeted a center from little-known Illinois Wesleyan named Jack Sikma.
I was asked to go look at him, and so I went to Kansas City. He played in the NAIA small college tournament, And when I watched him play, I came back because the Sonics at this time, they were starting to change their mind. The coach wanted Ernie Grunfeld, who was a good player. But I said to him, no, I don't think so. I said, I would stay with Jack. I said, because, you know, of Jack's size, he was getting double-figure rebounds every game. If he went to the foul line 10 times, he made 8 out of 10, you know, and he could score. He had a little step-back jump shot. And I said, no, I said, this guy really, I think, is going to be a good player, you know, and that would make a huge difference to our future. Sam went along with me in drafting Jack.
This all came as a bit of a surprise to Sigma.
So going into the draft, I thought I'd be a first-round pick. I didn't know where, and fortunately, a few days before the draft, my college coach got a call from Lenny and said, hey, if Jack's there, I think we're going to take him, and that was at pick number 8, so that was about 10 picks higher. So for the days leading into the draft, it was exciting, and I just hoped that Seattle was going to take me.
Well, that wasn't exactly what Sigma told Wilkins.
When I told him I was on draft, him, he said he didn't have the Sonics in mind, you know. It was funny. But I said, well, I have it in mind.
And I do remember in our first conversation when he asked me what I thought about Seattle, I said, well, I don't know much about Seattle. I said it wouldn't be my first choice. And Lenny came back to me. He says, well, he says, yeah, I have to tell you, you got to give Seattle a chance. It's a wonderful city, and the fans are great. And I just said, hey, coach, I just want to play basketball. I want to establish a career. And he says, well, that's what most guys want to do, and Seattle will be a good place for you. I look back at it as just you work so hard, and all of a sudden here's Seattle that's 10 picks higher than you think you were going to go a week before that. And then for me to say that, it was just a classic young and dumb statement. And it wasn't the last one I made, but it's definitely a memorable one.
And so we drafted Jack, and in the papers the next day it said, Jack who?
If there was skepticism within the Sonics organization about their new player, it wasn't satisfied by his summer league debut.
First of all, though there wasn't much negotiation, I missed the first like 4 or 5 days of summer league camp. And I thought I was in decent shape, but when you're not playing during the summer and it wasn't as sophisticated as far as, you know, having people and support to working out, you were really doing it on your own. So I came to summer league, and the first couple days of practice were a little rough as far as being in shape. And then we headed down to LA, and again, I was just getting my feet on the ground. The circumstances of me being drafted from where I came from, there was a lot of questions: who is this guy? What can he do? So the lights were on right away. My first game in the summer league, Moses Malone, who had played 4 years in the league, had decided to play for Houston, and we were playing Houston at the in our first game, and I got taken to the woodshed. I mean, points, rebounds, foul trouble. There was no foul out rule. I think I had 8 or 9 fouls, whatever.
And Moses scores against everybody, okay? And they beat the Sonics, the summer league team. And after the game, Moses had like 39. And the owner came in the locker room and he said, my God, you know, who drafted him, you know? And Bob Hopkins right away pointed, Lenny did.
The learning curve, I will say, from summer league through training camp, through early, and that's throughout my first season, the learning curve was vertical. But I never spent a lot of time worried about failure or any kind of outside pressures. I was really focused on trying to be the best basketball player I could be and then let the chips fall, and that's all you can do.
With that, the roster to start the 1977-78 season was complete. The Sonics brought back starting guards Slick Watts and Freddie Brown, the longest tenured members of the team, along with starting small forward Bruce Seals. The front court of Paul Silas and Marvin Webster, along with most of the bench, was new.
I don't think any of the preseason prognosticators thought we were going to be a playoff team, but I also don't think they thought we were going to be 5-17 either.
And I thought that we had a pretty good team, but they got off to a rough start. Bob Hopkins, who is a good guy, he was the coach, but for some reason the chemistry wasn't working, and maybe he just wasn't using it the ways that it could have been used. I never tried to second guess Bob. I liked him, but I wasn't going to interfere, you know, because he was the coach. And
here's how Fred Brown, one of the few holdovers who had played under Hopkins when he was assistant to Bill Russell, remembers it.
A little bit of a disarray because Hopkins wanted to do things his way, you know, which was more, you know, coming out of the South, New Orleans and all, and his style of play was really wasn't conducive for where the NBA was at. Structurally and everything else, and clearly that wasn't working for Sam Schumann and Zolly Volchek.
By the time forward Wally Walker arrived in a November 11th trade, the Sonics were already struggling.
Yeah, I was not just coming defending champion Portland Trailblazer team, but we started out that next season 10-1, so we had the best team, the best start of the regular season. We'd already played the Sonics twice in regular season, home and away. And we played them in the preseason at least once, maybe twice. So I'd seen the Sonics a fair amount, and they weren't very good. And the record reflected that. They were 2-10. It was Bob Hopkins was his first year as a coach. So Jack Ramsey, the Hall of Fame coach of the Blazers, finds me in a coffee shop in Atlanta to tell me I've been traded. Where to? Seattle. I'm like, oh, geez, you know, really? And then, of course, classic cocky, whatever I was, 23 years old. I said, well, what was I traded for? He said, a first and a second round pick. And I said, is that all you got? And the first round pick, by the way, is a lottery pick. So anyway, there you go. So then I had to fly cross country back to Portland, pick up some stuff, come up the next day, which was a Saturday, to Seattle. I arrive at the airport, and the guy that picks me up for the Sonics is Rick Welts. He's a PR director. Rick Welts, also now in the Hall of Fame.
Welts went on to work in the NBA league office, where he's credited with turning the All-Star game into All-Star weekend and helping launch the WNBA. He then became president of the Phoenix Suns and is now the president of the Golden State Warriors.
But he was running our PR department. So I go to the first practice, and it was a Saturday afternoon. We're going to play a game Sunday. And Hoppy was a great guy, great talent evaluator, but it was a disjointed practice, so much so that I'm looking around at the other guys thinking, it's a spoof on me, some of the drills. Like, you really, you're not serious about doing this. But it wasn't a spoof.
By the end of November, the situation had come to a head.
I was involved in a restaurant here that was having an opening one night, so I didn't go to the game. That night, they were playing the Nets, who at that time was not very good. And supposedly, people were saying that they were the worst team in the league, and they're playing them here in Seattle. And I didn't go to the game, and when I got home, my babysitter told me the owner had called and the general manager had called, you know. And so I got in touch, and they had lost that night. And and that made them 5-16.
That was the worst record in the West. The only team with the worst record, well, that was the Nets, who were still 3-16 even after that win in Seattle.
So when I talked with the owner, he had had it. He wanted to fire Bob Hopkins. He wanted me to go right away. He said, you know all these players, you know. He wanted me to take over as coach. And I said, well, I can't go tonight, you know. I mean, it'd have to be a day later. And the team had already left town to go to Denver. And they lost in Denver, and that made them 5-17. And a good friend of mine was one of the general managers there, Carl Scheer. Carl had made a comment, I don't know, it was in the paper, that the Sonics were one of the worst teams in the league. That they, you know, that's how they were playing. by now I had made the commitment to Sam that I would go and take over. So me and Zolly Volchak, who was the general manager, flew to Kansas City and met with Bob, told him that we were going to relieve him. He seemed relieved. He seemed relieved. And then I met with the players. I had a meeting with them before the game that night. And I told them that I believed in them, that I thought that they were a much better team than they showed, you know. And years later, I heard a comment by one of the guys, one of the players, when I said, made the comment that I thought they were better. He was wondering what I was smoking. But I truly believe that.
The player who made that comment, it was Walker.
All of us are there, and he says, I really think we have a lot of talent in this room. And I've said this before, but I'll say it again. Kind of look around again saying, really? He's not talking about this group. Is there somebody else he's referring to that's not here? Because there just wasn't any evidence that it was a very good team. We had some young guys that did have talent. I mean, Gus Williams, his talent was obvious to anybody who watched the team. But we really had some older players, too. So it wasn't like you said, okay, this is not just a team that can win now, but you know they got a bright future. But Lenny was right.
Brown was excited about the coaching change.
You know, I knew Lenny from day one when I got out here in 1971 because he was player coach. You know, Lenny had great experience, knew the community, and he had had put teams together that were successful. So having Lenny that knew all of us was ideal.
That night, I didn't change anything. I just limited what we ran. We got up by about 10, and we wind up winning by about 2 or 4. And now we flew to Boston. So it gave me a chance to really change the lineup, change how I wanted to do things, you know. And I changed the lineup. They were starting Slick Watts, Fred Brown, Bruce Seals, Paul Silas, and Marvin Webster. And the only guy I kept in the lineup was Marvin Webster. But I changed the other four. I wanted to start Gus Williams and Dennis Johnson, John Johnson, and Jack Sikma. So I changed the lineup. And we beat Boston in Boston, which was a rarity, you know. And then we came home and we won 10 straight. It was crazy. It was crazy. Yeah.
Actually, Sikma remembers there was one change to the lineup in Kansas City. He was temporarily out of the starting five.
My contract, I had a couple bonuses. If we made the playoffs, I made 10 grand extra, and I was making $100,000 at the time. And if we made the finals, I made 10 grand extra. And if I started 15 games, I'd make 10 grand extra. Well, you start talking about 20 or 30% opportunity at that time. 1977, 1978. And so the last game, what ended up to be the last game Bob Hopkins coached, he started me for the first time. Then we had a coaching change, and Lenny came in and had a meeting and said, hey, I like this group. We're going to stay with this group. I'm confident in this group. I think we can win with this group. And that night he started a different lineup. And so I didn't start. And closest friend at the time, Joe Hassett, who we were renting a house together, both rookies. I remember him come up to me and said, oh, that's too bad, Jack, but, you know, see what happens. Well, the very next game, Lenny tried a different starting lineup, so I was back in. And it turned out that from then on out for actually, I think the next 4 years or so, I never missed a game and was in the starting lineup.
In part, the change was forced because Fred Brown was out with a knee injury at that point. He was comfortable with a bench role when he returned. His fellow starting guard, Slick Watts, was not.
I had gone to Lenny. Lenny and I had a conversation, and I was in complete agreement. Lenny, look, let me come off the bench, okay? I know what to do. I know how to get it done. I think it would be a better combination having Gus with his quickness and speed and his agility, and Dennis with his power, you know, in terms of his height, his arm span, and his ability to play, you know, the top guys. You know, it just made sense to let those young guys, you know, Gus and DJ, be in the starting lineup. And I was trying to convince Slick that, you know, it made all the sense in the world for me, because I let, you know, Gus and DJ get out there and tire those guys out. So when I came in, you know, I knew what was going on, because I was really a student of the game, and I could, you know, get things done. And in the fourth quarter, you know, Lenny, you know, he would need me on the court for my mental frame of mind and strategically and how we would do things. And as it turned out, it was a great thing. I thought it was ideal. Slick didn't buy into it. Slick wanted to continue to start. And I told him, Slick, this is not a good deal. You know, we don't need to start. We just need to win. We have the makings. We need to win. Slick wanted to start. He and Lenny didn't see eye to eye on that. And Lenny made the decision and he moved him.
Wilkins saw John Johnson's playmaking ability is key to making the lineup work.
I said that if JJ gets the ball, you guys take off, because he'll find you. Because he was like a point forward. You know, he could really handle the ball, because we played together, and I knew that. So I felt like that lineup, they were unselfish, they could score. And then I thought that Fred would bring a dimension off the bench that no team had, the way he could shoot. I felt Paul Silas, at this point in his career, was better coming off the bench, and that he could give us that physical presence we needed. So that was my thinking in that lineup.
From Sickman's perspective, the balance of both starters and bench was ideal.
I think it wasn't just the starting lineup. I think just the rotation that Lenny had, and he made some decisions. A tough one for Slick. Slick was coming off the bench and maybe not playing the minutes. And in the middle of the year, I think both sides agreed to make a change. I think he tried to have a mixture of some, at least one veteran in with the young group, and John Johnson served that purpose on the starting lineup and kind of brought some toughness and, you know, stability to the lineup, because we was really Dennis and Gus and myself, and even Marvin was the first time we were really kind of starting unit guys. But it was also, if we were struggling, he could bring in some veterans off the bench, and Fred, of course, had instant offense and knew how to play, and Paul Silas, and to have that stability on the bench really was key.
With that, the Sonics took off. They won their next six games and 11 of their first 12 with Wilkins as coach, the only loss coming in overtime at home to the Washington Bullets.
You know, we started to take off. You know, we implemented some plays and we implemented some strategies, and we had great chemistry. We all got along. We all understood. And everybody said, hey, Fred is willing to do that. I can do it, you know. So everybody bought into the program. And we became a solid team.
The one exception was, as mentioned, Watts, who could never adjust to a smaller role as fourth guard after being the team's star for many years in the face of the franchise. He was traded in early January to New Orleans.
I talked to him today. He's just a great guy. He was a great teammate to have around. But him getting demoted to versus not playing, he went from the starting guard icon to that fourth guard. He wasn't ready for that, and he forced a trade. Sonics made a good trade, got a first-round pick for Slick, but that was what happened.
By that point, the Sonics, and even the rest of the world, had started to believe.
We were very good. We were better in practice. Our practices were super.
Lenny had taken over, and we started to win games both at home and on the road. And again, the first goal was a fight to get back to 500, which I think we were close to at Christmas or New Year's. And then it was a case of, well, if we can keep up this pace, we can get our in the middle of the playoffs. And, you know, we worked our way to, I think we were the fourth seed, and at least had home court advantage in that three-game. The momentum also and the belief started to show with the reaction of the fans. I mean, the Coliseum became just a madhouse. I think people saw that there was some possibilities for us to really do some damage in the playoffs. And again, I got to hand it to the veteran leadership on the team. They really kept pounding that, hey, this isn't enough. We can get more than this. Let's keep our eye on the prize and keep going.
The Sonics finished the 1977-78 regular season with a 47-35 record, having gone 42-18 since the coaching change, to finish fourth in the Western Conference. After beating the LA Lakers 2-1 in a mini-series, winning both games at home, they met the defending champion Blazers, who started the season 50-10 before star center Bill Walton suffered a broken foot. For Wilkins, who had coached Portland the year before the title, there was a little something extra at stake in this matchup.
Well, I was kind of anxious. I knew all the players. I had helped pick all those guys, you know. I didn't think they would be anticipating how aggressive we would be, and I thought we had a great shot at beating them. And then Bill wasn't 100%, you know, but even with him, I thought we could beat them, you know, because I thought that we could be more physical with them. I was highly motivated to beat Portland.
So was Walker, who had just been traded away by the Blazers.
Oh, I was all hopped up for that series. I talked too much. We'd have a scouting report, and the coaches would go through it about, you know, what the Blazers were trying to run, and I'd interrupt and say, no, this, here's where the cut comes from, because I'd run that office for a while. I did know it, but I didn't know enough just to shut up, and it'd be okay.
Despite Portland's championship experience and gaudy record with Walton in the lineup, the Sonics were confident entering the series.
We believe we could compete with them. We could get them. And the fact that we were able to get game one in Portland, I think, shocked a lot of people. We had a shot at another one of those games, and it didn't work out. But it was really a case, if we can get one there, our mindset was we weren't going to get beat at home. And that was the case with Portland, where we got one there and hung on and won game six at home to go on to Denver. And
despite Walton's 17 points and 16 rebounds in his first action more than a month and a half, the Sonics won game one of the series in Portland. The Blazers fought back to win game two, but x-rays taken after the game revealed that Walton had rebroken his foot. He would never play for Portland again. The Sonics won all three remaining games in Seattle and the series 4-2, knocking out the defending champs.
And when we beat them, it shocked everybody. Yeah. It really did.
For the West Finals, the Sonics were on more even footing against a Denver team that had won the Midwest Division with only one more win than them during the regular season. It was also a revenge series, this time for Silas and Webster, who had been traded by Denver the previous summer.
The thing with Denver is that they still had David Thompson, and who was a great, great player. But I felt that if someone could make him work hard, it would be Dennis. And Dennis was outstanding. I knew that he was going to give us that chance we needed defensively. So, and then having Paul Silas, who was a physical presence, and he could get into players' heads as well, you know. So he was a great guy to have on the bench. We were motivated, let's say. And knocking Portland out surprised everybody but us.
The Denver series was Marvin and Paul. Were key pieces for us from that trade. Paul Silas was amazing through that whole process. First year, his focus and his challenging team to get more, we can do more, I know we can, that kind of thing. And that showed up probably a little extra in that Denver series. He wanted to beat him so bad. I don't think Paul Silas and Larry Brown hit it off, and that was one of the reasons of this trade.
Just as in the previous series, the Sonics earned a split on the road in Denver and then won all three games home in Seattle to take the series 4-2. For the first time ever, the Sonics were headed to the NBA Finals. Their opponents? The Washington Bullets, who had lost the finals to the Golden State Warriors as heavy favorites 3 years earlier. This time around, the Sonics would actually have home court advantage against the Bullets, who went 44-38 during the regular season.
You know, I knew it would be tough because you had Wes Unsell, you had Elvin Hayes, you know, Bobby Dandridge. Those were some guys that had playoff experience. They've been there. They know what it was going to take to win. But I thought that, you know, playing at home, we'd have a shot at it.
Because of scheduling issues in Seattle, the 1978 NBA Finals was played under an unusual format where the Sonics hosted Game 1 before heading out on the road for two games and returning home for two more. After taking Game 1 at home and stealing Game 3 in Landover, Maryland by a 93-92 final, the Sonics came back with a chance to close out the series in Seattle. With the Coliseum hosting a home show, the Sonics played Game 4 in front of nearly 40,000 fans at the Kingdom, the home of the NFL Seahawks, baseball's Mariners, and the NASL version of the Sounders. While it would soon become home to the Sonics too, it didn't feel that way in the NBA Finals.
The Kingdom, we had a lot of people, we set a record, but it would take some getting used to. And we all say, a basketball court's a basketball court. But when you have the open space behind and in between and everything, depth perception changes, okay? And it did with some of the players, you know. So I think, yeah, it made a little different.
Now, Sam made a ton of money because we had 40,000-plus people there, but it was not a home game for us. It was like an away game. We lost that game, and that put us behind.
We got ahead of ourselves maybe a little bit in the motion, and you know, they're a veteran team, tough, grinded out team, and they were able to get the one they needed.
By this point, Bullets coach Dick Motta had become synonymous with the phrase, "The opera ain't over till the fat lady sings," which he'd adopted as a warning against overconfidence when Washington took a 3-1 lead in an earlier series. Now, Motta had used it to keep faith among the Bullets as they trailed this time. Sonics players and coaches were amused rather than annoyed with Motta.
We all kind of got a kick out of him. He was a funny guy, and funny over on the sidelines. He was a little guy, just kind of walk around over there and was always talking. Bernie Bickerstaff, of course, Sonics fans will remember, was always on the sideline calling out all of our plays. Every time we called a play, Bernie was up yelling, telling the Bullets players, you know, how to defend it, which if we ran it right, it wouldn't matter. But Bernie was vocal too. So I don't remember much of any discussion about what Dick Motta said, but we had a series that was winnable and, in fact, should have been won by us.
I grew up watching Dick Motta coach the Bulls, so I was a Dick Motta fan.
Dick is crazy, and he's a good guy. I got to know him real well, you know, and of course he came up with that quote about the fat lady, the opera's not over until the fat lady sings, you know. But these were all guys who I had respected, and I think they respected me.
When the Sonics won Game 5 by a 98-94 final back at the Coliseum to take a 3-2 lead in the series, the Fat Lady was warming up. But Washington dominated Game 6 at home 117-82, at the time the largest margin ever in an NBA Finals game, to force a deciding Game 7 back in Seattle.
Well, mostly I remember up 3-2 and thinking, well, we'll go back and win Game 6, and if we don't, evidently, maybe we didn't approach that Game 6 as well as we should have because we got killed in Game 6. But certainly, we all felt, as did the city, you know, there's no way that team is going to lose a Game 7 at home.
They did.
I remember it was a struggle from the beginning. We were battling, trying to come back, trying to work our way back. The classic thing of we get a little closer and then they make a little run. I remember, I think Charles Johnson hit a freaking half-court shot at the end of the third quarter to expand the lead maybe to 13 or 11 or something like that. And again, that only counted as a two back then. The biggest memory is in the fourth quarter there was coming back maybe within five and missed, kind of bounced long, kind of hit the floor. Kupchak came up with it, foul, and won. And so, and you know, that's could have been a considered a five-point swing where if we had gotten the rebound and gone down and scored, we might have put a little more pressure on him.
Two plays I remember, you know, more clearly than any others were two that were unfortunate for us. Charles Johnson hitting the shot from the top of the key as he was falling down. well covered, defended shot to just, he made a great shot. The other one was a loose ball, just rolling under the basket that could have gone to either team under the Bullets basket. And Mitch Kupchak actually being the one to be able to pick it up and lay it in at a crucial point, you know, late in the game.
Just didn't play well enough and didn't make enough shots. And I still feel it. I still feel the kind of the stunning reaction to everyone when the final buzzer rang and we missed out, and walking off the court and the crowd was quiet for a bit, and then all of a sudden you started hearing some applause, and then everybody, you know, showed their appreciation for what a heck of a year we had.
Well, there was disappointment in the Sonics locker room that they had come so close to winning a championship and fallen short. There was also excitement about what lay ahead.
There was a mixture of disappointment and appreciation, I think. Disappointment in that we were so close and we worked so hard and, you know, we just weren't able to take that last step. And I think the realization, appreciation of we had a heck of a journey. And the people in this locker room were, you know, connected and made the commitment, and have to feel good about that and good about each other. So the experience was fantastic. The outcome was just a little short.
Well, the 78 season, you know, I don't even talk about that a lot because it was so painful losing in seven games to those guys. I recall, you know, JJ, Paul, and myself, we were in the sauna and we said, no way, no bleeping way are these guys going to do this to us. We lost this. They were more seasoned than we were. But we lost this, and we're coming back, and we're going to kick their butts. We're going to beat them because we know we can take them. And every game that we got, every time we got into a tight fix, we remember what our goal is. We're winning this, you know. Every time we got into a tight fix, we were telling ourselves, we're going to do this.
In the locker room, you know, guys are down and everything, and I told them, I said, hey, we'll be back here next year and we're going to win this. They thought I was a little crazy, but still, I think they believed in it because they saw the accomplishments we made that year. I was excited about it. I thought that no one anticipated that Seattle would do as well as we had done. I was excited about the next year.
100%. The attitude was, okay, we got this far. We're disappointed. We had an opportunity. But yeah, as far as we know, we're all coming back. It's a relatively young group. People are under contract, except for Marvin Webster, which is a big part of the next year's story. And the championship's our goal. It's a realistic goal. So here we go.
You know, we knew we were going to get basically the same team back other than the Marvin Webster free agency, which was a big thing.
Yeah, it was over the summer, and there were rumblings. And Marvin was such a positive, popular guy on the team. He had a great sense of humor and practical joker and nicknames for everybody. And he was just a fun guy to be around. And he'd had a really good year after coming off, you know, really bad health issues prior in his career at Denver. He had hepatitis and, you know, life-endangering hepatitis. So he blossomed. He was happy. You know, so we just assumed, of course, he's coming back, and here we go. So we get the news over the summer that, no, he's not going to be back. He didn't sign with the Knicks, I don't believe, if I get my sequence right, until after we'd acquired Tom Lagarde in a draft day trade with Denver. But everyone is at that point, okay, we got a good young backup center in Tom Lagarde. No one was saying, okay, he's going to be the starting center because we might lose Marvin. No, everyone assumed Marvin's coming back. Same guys. Here we go. So it was a shock.
Well, we heard that the Knicks were talking to him and they were making an offer, that the Sonics couldn't match. And you know, I wasn't happy about it, but I understand what players at the time, they only have so many years. And here's an opportunity for him to get a huge, huge salary. Who could match New York at that time, you know? So I was disappointed. I tried to talk to him, but by then he wouldn't answer any calls. I mean, he had the guy representing him was handling everything. And so I just figured, okay, we're going to have to adjust. And at that time, you had to replace the team. You had to sort of make it whole. And they wanted to give me Bob McAdoo, who was a good offensive player. But I had seen Lonnie Shelton play because he played for Oregon State, you know. And I said, no, I want Lonnie. And they were surprised, but they shouldn't have been because I was living out here. And I went and I saw a lot of the college games. And so we finally agreed, and they gave me Lonnie Shelton. He was great for the team. The players loved him. Physical presence on the floor.
There was a new player playing the center position, and Tom came in and fit right in. Again, it was hard to be as effective defensively at the rim because Marvin was, you know, one of the best in the league and so long. But, you know, we started the season, and then I think just before the season started, Lonnie was compensation, and he came in, so Lenny kept us still the same starting lineup, and Lonnie and Paul would come off the bench, and then Tom blew out his knee. So for me, that was the big adjustment, where I was probably playing two-thirds of my time against fours, and mobility and that kind of thing were more important to now all of a sudden two-thirds of the or full-time, I'm playing center. My time on the court is at center position.
The Sonics were off to a 16-6 start when Legarde suffered a torn ACL.
People have forgotten because he wasn't around for the playoffs. He was playing great. He just had his career high at home. It might have even been the game before that. I think he had 34 points in a game, which he hadn't played that much as a rookie in Denver. So he was averaging double figures on a really good, if not great, team at that point. Jack was the one who started slowly that year. He just didn't get it going. He was shooting a shooting percentage in the 30s, I think even low 30 percentage range. But we were winning easily, even with him struggling early that year. And it speaks to how well, you know, Tommy had played, Lonnie Shelton coming off the bench, the whole group, and the guard corps was always great. So there we are. And Jack now went from, if it was early December, if I remember correctly, when Tommy got hurt in Philly, to Jack having to slide over. He was really our only player of size then. I'm talking about 6'10 and up. So he had to play center. Lonnie obviously moves to the power forward, and we're like, okay, well, Lonnie's good, but also we're not so big or so deep anymore. So let's see. Well, Jack, all he did was go from struggling as the starting power forward to, within 2 months of Tommy going down, he gets named to his first All-Star team as a center in the Western Conference, because that team got named in late January. You know, of course, what we discovered, but it wasn't as clear then. It's funny how that works. Things come really clear, the benefit of looking backwards. But center was his natural position. The other thing is he got much stronger. He weighed, I think, 230 pounds when he came in as a rookie, and then he got stronger, heavier, and really used his weight strength in the low post. You know, he was still posted up when he was playing a four. Just if you got a smaller four man on him, he would do his inside pivot. But at center, you know, that's when he really became the dominant defensive rebounder that he did.
There was one brief stumble for the Sonics during late December.
I don't remember any wavering of the belief that we were a championship caliber team, but we did lose six straight games. I'd have to go back and look at history, and maybe you have. Championship teams don't typically lose six straight games. Yeah, everyone has injuries, and we did. But if you have a championship caliber team, you usually find a way to not lose six in a row, and we still did that, and then bounce back.
In fact, in the last four decades, just two other NBA champions have had six-game losing streaks, Detroit in 2004 and Dallas in 2011.
You know, you can call me an optimist or whatever. I still felt we were going to be okay. But people were starting to get concerned. And then you know how the media is sometimes. A couple of them thought maybe us winning last year was a fluke.
Turns out the losing streak was the fluke. As of the All-Star break, the Sonics had the West's best record at 34-16, meaning Wilkins was chosen to coach the All-Star game. Sonics players Sikma and Dennis Johnson were picked for the West team a year after the Sonics did not have any All-Stars in 1978. The Sonics were also getting used to playing at the Kingdom full-time after moving from their smaller home at the Coliseum.
You lost some of the atmosphere. Listen, our fans were still fantastic, and we had huge crowds. I think it was next year we set the attendance record, but we might have set the attendance record that year as well. We just beat it the following year. And so there were a lot of people there, and they were enthusiastic, but it wasn't the same intimate, loud, raucous feel just because so much of that got lost with the space.
The Kingdom was also cold.
They didn't have the Kings quite worked out in the Kingdom that first year. But if you see any old pictures of the fans in the early years of playing, the Sonics playing in the Kingdom, you'll see the fans all still have their winter coats on and usually their hats on. The players, we would have our normal warm-ups, but we'd have a layer of a sweatshirt and sweatpants underneath our, because when you open the doors, they didn't have it worked out, any kind of insulation so to keep the cold air from outside. So you get a 30, 40 degree night in Seattle in January, so open the doors and all the cold air would rush in. So it just stayed so incredibly cold that, one, for those of us coming off the bench, which I did, you get the call to go in a game, it would take you a while to get under, because you had so many layers on. And we had blankets on. We take the blanket off, then comes one layer of warm-ups, then comes the sweatshirt. Then you get in the game and you just, you know, please don't let me tear something before, you know, I get up and down the court a couple of times. It wasn't any better for the visiting teams, though. So we were good at home. We were a really good team. But it was really cold.
The Sonics finished the 1978-79 regular season with a 52-30 record, the best in franchise history. Five more wins than the previous season, and good for the top seed in the West and a bye to the semifinals. There, they would for the second consecutive year face the LA Lakers and their center Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
You could not be worried about any team with Kareem because he was just so great at that point in his career.
This time, Sikma would have to defend Kareem.
You know, cut my teeth on Kareem that year. He was really tough. You know, you got to do all your work before he catches it. The rules were different. All you do is kind of chest him a little bit. It was really fortunate that Lenny had the foresight to bring in an Autry. And Dennis had the sturdiness about him and it played him so much. So really in that series, I might have played about half the time against them. And Dennis played, got a good chunk of them. But, you know, Kareem's the type of player that if he gets it going, you know, it's hard to stop. We never did a lot of double teaming or whatever. We would dig down on dribbles and that kind of thing. But Kareem, you know, he usually puts it down once and it's into his hook. So we were able to do a good enough job to beat him in five. I think game two went to overtime. I remember I had a shot. It got blocked by Kareem and ran it down and turned, and there was DJ open up in the baseline and hit him, and he made the shot at the buzzer to put it into overtime. We won that game. That's kind of one of those plays that if it went the other way, we're down or we lose home court, and it's the Lakers. So it was challenging.
It was a very tough series, and but we love going to L.A. in the sunny weather, and we love showing them what we could do in the Forum, because the Forum was pretty much Laker heaven, and it was showtime for us.
After winning Game 2 at home in overtime, the Sonics earned a split at the Forum in L.A. and came back home to finish off the series 4-1. But it was closer than that indicates. The Sonics' last three wins came by a combined 13 points. It was on to the West Finals, where the Sonics would face their toughest test against the Phoenix Suns.
Yeah, well, they were really good and a really interesting smaller team. It wasn't that they were so quick. It's just they were so skilled and shot it so well. Alvin Adams was not that much bigger than me. In fact, we'd been roommates playing for the USA just 3 summers before that when he was at Oklahoma and I was both after our freshman year in college. So I know for sure he wasn't that much bigger, but he was an effective, skilled center. Then you had Paul Westphal at that point was the first team All-Pro two guard, probably the best two guard in the game for in that era, the late 70s. You had Gar Hurd, Walter Davis. Walter Davis was a guy I played against in college, was a smaller small forward, 6'5", but really skilled, a great shooter, great scorer. So it was a different kind of matchup where they were really good and had a successful run, and particularly late in the year, but just could really score and score quickly. And
after winning the first two games at home, the Sonics seemed to catch a break when Adams, Phoenix's starting center, injured his ankle in the opening moments of Game 3. Enter his backup, Joel Kramer, a rookie listed at 6'7", 203, who gave Sigma surprising trouble.
Yeah, and I really struggled offensively, and a lot had to do with Joel, and he was smaller, kind of underneath me, and I guess I'd never been in a position where it became such a focus in the series. And then for the series to go, we won 2 and then lost 3 while this matchup was happening. It was a growth opportunity for me as far as dealing with all that. Fortunately, again, there was a player too, and we were able to win game 6 and kind of monkey off my back. And for that time of my career, I never felt so much pressure as I did at that point in time.
As Sigma said, the Sonics lost 3 in a row after Adams' injury, including, shockingly, Game 5 back home in Seattle. Suddenly, they faced a must-win Game 6 in Phoenix to keep their season alive while the Suns tried to reach the NBA Finals. The game was played on the afternoon of Mother's Day, and Paul Westphal's mom came out to sing the national anthem.
I recall it being a very nice rendition of the national anthem, and I had this image of Paul coming out to give her flowers at the end of the national anthem. So anyway, it was a nice touch by them, and you know, a little emotional deal. And of course, we were more, you know, let's get on with the game. It's all well and good. Let's play the game. And
I remember looking at Paul. He looked at me. We all kind of, when we went in the locker room, you know, before we came back out on the court, and we said, no bleeping way. They're going to disrespect us like that on Mother's Day. You know, do that. It was no disrespect of Paul's mom singing and all that. It's like, you're not doing that to us. We ain't losing this game. We are not losing this game.
That makes for a great story. The fact that it was on Mother's Day and the fact that she sang is unique. But it was a game 6 that we had to have. And you can call it any day you want. The important thing is we had to find a way to win. And there was aura presence in the locker room, Paul and the veterans. I mean, they were just couldn't wait to get out there and go at them. And
seeing Paul Silas before that game in the locker room at the old Phoenix Coliseum was something that I always remember, and I still have this clear visual of him sitting in his chair in the middle of that locker room, bloodshot eyes, breathing heavily, audibly, doing this weird thing he did with his fingers as he tried to get his stickum on applied appropriately. And the rest of us, well, we had success, and we've been with Paul now for a couple years as a teammate. We hadn't had an elimination game except Game 7 the year before. And so here we were, and Paul had played in Phoenix. That might have been part of it, but I think it was mostly here was a guy that won 2 championships in Boston, was a physical player, great leader, great teammate, and he was setting the tone. Hey, guys, I'm getting ready for this game. Here's the intensity that we need to be able to win Game 6, the Western Conference Finals on the road. So he set the great tone without saying a word. You know, you better be ready because this is what it takes.
This is why I got him. You know, I played with Paul. I mean, you know, we've known each other a long time in St. Louis. okay? When he was a rookie, we used to play one-on-one. I'd be all over him because I thought he could be a heck of a player. Paul was one of the finest rebounders, and he couldn't jump but that high. I would tease him, but he knew how to box out and move you out of position and stuff like that. He set the tone in the locker room, and that's what veteran players can do. And he let the guys know that we weren't losing that game.
As ready as the Sonics were, they still trailed by 8 going into the fourth quarter and were one period away from elimination. But they kept putting the pressure on the Suns and finally broke through late.
I think as left-hand side of the court, Gus came down and made a, I don't know, an 18-footer that finally put us up one. And then I think they had a couple opportunities to tie it up. And Garher and I think Walter Davis missed a shot, too, that went off us out of bounds. So it was like the last 30-some seconds, they got multiple opportunities. And I was the one that I was guarding Gar on that last play, and Walter Davis, they ran a play for him, and I kind of hedged off Gar a little bit to help, and then they threw the pass over the top to Gar, and I remember closing out and looking at his eyes with hands straight up, and I didn't, you know, I was making sure I wasn't following him, but contest as hard as I could. Got down on the ground, turned around, and it was long. So, and that was it. So it was a huge win.
Any NBA fan that was watching, and it was my senior year of college, but I'm watching the NBA Finals to see him make that shot he made in Boston Garden to, I believe, send that game into overtime against the Celtics, one of the all-time great NBA games, one of the biggest shots, most famous shots in Finals history. And all of a sudden, you know, they get the ball back with a chance at a final shot with a second to go, and the ball ends up in his hands. And we're just sitting there, and no one was saying a word, but I know we were all thinking it. You know, could lightning strike twice here, and the same guy in a similar situation, and fortunately for us, different result.
Feed out to Davis, shoots from 18 feet, it is no good. Set the going for the rebound, tipped it out of bounds with 1 second on the clock. The Suns will have the ball and 1 second to score as Seattle leads them by one. Here we go. Boozy and Bonds. He finally gets it in a hurry and puts up a 15-footer at the buzzer. No good. The Sonics win the ball game. The Sonics win the ball game, tie it up, and it'll come back to the Kingdome for game number 7 on Thursday night. The final score as the Seattle Supersonics win at Phoenix this afternoon. The final score, Seattle 106 and Phoenix 105.
We were not letting them beat us there. And we knew if we did that game, we win that game, going home, it was over. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we went after that. That was a defining moment for us, winning that game. And winning that game, we knew we could take it all.
Well, just euphoria. But in a limited fashion, because it's not like our work is done. We're going back to Seattle, but now it feels like a reprieve from the governor. You know, we're going home. Here's a game we maybe should have lost. We were down, you know, much of the second half and the fourth quarter, found a way to win it. So, you know, we're going home and let's take care of business.
And when we came back home, that's all they talked about on the way back, was that being ready for the game at home, that we were going to win this game no matter what.
I thought we did a really good job of keeping our focus, you know, because that didn't mean anything if we didn't get the next one, and we were able to get it at home.
We actually, the game was closer than it should have been. We got out to a big lead. You know, I turned it over a little bit late. I shouldn't have, but
we might have celebrated a little bit early, and then they weren't done, and they kept coming. But anyway, I know I came out of the game, and I got put back in, and I ended up, I think I had to make a free throw or two or something late to just – we were in good shape, but it kind of finished it off.
And Dennis Johnson steals the inbound pass, throws the ball near the ceiling, and the Sonics win the Western Conference NBA Championship. The final score. Tonight's final score, the Seattle Supersonics, 114, and the Phoenix Suns, 110.
For me, I just felt that was a huge sigh of relief. One, we were in a tough situation. We're at risk. But the other part was, I think our mindset was, if we just get back there, and then for it to be the bullets again, I felt that we were going to figure it out.
Delighted, euphoric, I use that word again, but it's true. But probably more than any of that, relieved. Hey, this game six gave us a second chance. We took care of business at home.
We knew that it was our time to get after these guys. And it wasn't going to be any of that Mitch Kupchak falling on the floor crap or Wes Unseld, you know, beating Jack up. We were going after it. We were going after that. But we knew our mindset was that these are the guys we've always wanted. This is our series. This is our time.
Stay tuned. In part two of our special series looking back at the 1979 Seattle Supersonics Championship, the rematch is on with the Washington Bullets in the NBA Finals. Then, the aftermath of the title and the legacy of those Sonics teams 40 years later. Thanks for listening. I'm Kevin Pelton, and this has been a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast.
Sonics, yeah, you're okay. You bring us all the thrills of the NBA. It's great to hear that Sonic will hit the dunk when the Supersonics play at home.